Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
The last thing they saw was someone they trusted. You're tuned in to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreek.
We are about to dive into the tangled web of the Delphi murder case, a story that has confounded investigators, rattled the public, and left countless unanswered questions in its wake. Richard Allen, convicted for the brutal murders of Liberty German and Abigail Williams, now challenging his conviction with claims of ignored confessions, shaky forensic evidence, and prosecutorial missteps. With us is retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, Robin Dreek. Robin, when you look at a case like this, one with conflicting timelines, potential investigative oversights, and questions about the suspect's confessions, how does law enforcement ensure objectivity when they are investigating something like this?
Well, ensuring objectivity, isn't that the great challenge of everything in life? But in everything we do as investigators and in every case, the first thing I'm always looking for, as we talk about repeatedly together, is I'm looking for patterns of behavior. And it's one of the greatest reasons why I am not on the school that Richard Allen is actually committed those crimes. And because, and I want to address this because some people say, well, he confessed. And so, and I've always, and they keep saying, you don't have to have a motive for people to do these things. And I'm not talking about motive here because motive, it doesn't matter to me. Mm-hmm. What I'm looking for is it fits the pattern of behavior that it's reasonable that he would have done this. And the prosecution never said that this behavior fits the pattern of behavior. Matter of fact, his confession, the way he confessed that he did it, doesn't fit a pattern of his own life behavior. It fits a pattern of behavior for someone under the duress he was in the jail system in isolation. That fits a pattern of behavior, believe it or not. Him doing these acts doesn't. Because there's a few things in here that are major gaps for me. And this is where we get into the investigation where we're at and why I think this appeal is a great thing they're going for. And that is his confession and what he said he did doesn't fit anything else in his life. You know, and the biggest thing is he had no contact or knowledge of these girls that I've seen in any of the evidence. And yet now you have this person, another person that has a jailhouse confession, mm-hmm. who the girls were murdered on the property. He knew one of the fathers, he claims. And it fits a pattern of this guy's behavior. And yet they completely ignored it throughout the trial. And so you have, on one hand, you have Richard Allen, who did not fit the pattern of behavior. This other guy, there's data points to say we need to, not saying guilty, we're saying we need to look at this because these patterns of behaviors more likely fit the crime that was committed. Because I'm looking for data points. And I'm not saying right or wrong, guilty or not guilty. I'm saying it just doesn't fit. No motive, just behaviors.
Why do you think they didn't? I mean, if the goal here at the end of the day is to find your guy, it seems like they had a lot of options before they got to Richard Allen that really, if you wanted to railroad somebody, you could have picked any of these guys and you'd probably have a much stronger case than you did against Richard Allen. But they picked Richard Allen and then they just pretty much said, you can't defend yourself and good luck. And then that's where we are today. They didn't allow him to bring any of the missteps up, anything that was done during the investigation, which is highly questionable, but they just kept going down that road. I mean, this goes beyond like blinders, it feels like. You have Keegan Klein, you have Ron Logan, you have this guy who made this confession, who we don't even know who he is, in jail, right, talking about a box cutter. There was a lot of people who said I did it or had a lot of evidence pointing to them likely being involved. But we went to Richard Allen. So when we're talking about objectivity in an investigation, I don't think that even existed. What do you think was going through those investigators' minds that allowed this to go down such a weird track? No pun intended.
you know, I wish I could come up with this brilliant idea or concept behind what would motivate someone to do this. But unfortunately, from my optic of things that I've seen throughout my career, when someone gets lazy and does a lazy investigation or a haphazard collection of something or interview of someone, and then they double down on their misdeed, it just spools out of control. I really just think this was started off as lazy investigation, looking for an easy answer. Maybe someone related to Alan or Alan himself pissed one of these guys off at some juncture along the way, and they said, you know what, screw this guy. Not thinking there's going to be the kind of a public attention that's been on this, and it just spooled out of control. And people don't like admitting when they're wrong. People push back with all their might for their own confirmation bias. Once they have their own biases in their head of what they want to happen, because they don't want to invalidate their own thoughts and opinions, especially in the face of others, they're going to double down on those things, unless, like you said, unless you have objectivity. And when everyone gets caught up in groupthink and an easy solution. Now, granted, the motives could have been very, very good. I never discount the motives of the investigators of wanting to bring some peace and some movement forward for the families. Because again, let's go back to the victims here. That's all that matters at this point to me, is all the victims. Now we have multiple victims now if Alan's actually not guilty. But at the same time, though, you know, if you have investigators wanting to bring some closure to the family, you have what looks like something on a whim, like, oh, this is a quick, easy out, and then a little bit of laziness kicks in, and then you double down on it, you spool out of control, that snowball starts up, and it gets big really fast. I think, again, just conjecture. I don't think it was intentional at the get-go. I think it just got out of control really fast.
Do you think it ever was intentional? Because it's easy for us to look at this and go, oh, they really got it in for him. But is it just where it snowballed and then groupthink came out and everybody just kept believing that whatever anybody said before them must be true, regardless if it is or not, regardless of if it was investigated properly or not, or somebody just said it out loud. It seems that there was a lot of that, just somebody speaking their mind of maybe a theory this way or that way, and then, yeah, that's what it is. And it just kept building and building and building. But it required so many different people and different agencies all to simultaneously go down this same road, which I think is the weird part about all of this, which makes it look very much like a conspiracy, because you have so many different individuals that could have their own individual opinions that could have spoken up at any time going, hey, wait a second, because we're screaming about it before the trial even started. So many people were screaming about it before the trial even started, but nothing seemed to break through. Nobody seemed to take that hint and go, maybe there is something to this over here. There was just kind of like, no, we got it. And we're hoping maybe in court they'd have something to back it up. They didn't. They had nothing. It was just, yep, this is what we're doing. How does that happen on such a broad scale?
It's unusual. They don't happen all that often. So to me, you know, if we start with the dial in the middle and we're looking at, are we on the conspiracy side or are we just stupid mistake side and we double down on stupid? You know, on the conspiracy side, first of all, they're very, very rare when these things happen. But when they do, generally there's some data point along the way. Someone has some personal agenda, some personal vendetta, something personally to gain from something that allows that conspiracy to kind of take hold here. In this case so far, again, I could be blind to it. We could be blind to it. I haven't seen or I don't know of a connection between any of the initial investigators and Nat Allen individually that there would be a target against there or any other kind of relation. In other words, I don't see a linkage that would say, let's get them. Mm-hmm. There might be that we're blind to, but without seeing a linkage, because again, most, even murders, people generally, I think it's, what's the percentage, 85 to 90% of all murders, it's someone that's known to that person in their environment. Well, it's the same thing with a getcha. Mm-hmm. People don't randomly just want to get someone. There's a reason behind it, and I just don't see the linkage. And there could be. I just don't see. That's why if you look at the probability of conspiracies, which is low, and you look at the probability of there always being a connection when there is, mm-hmm. those are the things I'm not seeing. That's why I tend to, if the needle's on stupid double down or conspiracy, I'm slightly going on the side just doubling down on stupid and groupthink, just mm-hmm. because that's where I'm seeing more limited data points going down on this one, because there's so much stupid on this one though.
Well, I mean, right. It seems to be a lot of stupid. It seems to be a very inexperienced force who doesn't deal with things like this very often. Yes. Again, not making excuses, but it's part of the recipe here. If you go to the stupid, nobody wants to admit they're stupid. How difficult, and the emotional aspect of this. This is a small community. You have two little girls that get killed out in a place where a lot of people like to go and walk in an otherwise peaceful town. You're going to have an aspect of, you know, probably more passion for this than you would if it was just, you know, some, you know, stranger that wandered through town and killed some random people, or if you were in a larger environment. This really hits home and more people are going to be affected by it. Do you think that played a role in this in terms of putting blinders on? And how difficult is it to not put blinders on when you're investigating a case that you're very passionate about and really has some real consequences?
Yeah, all those things definitely play into this. And also when you have someone like Alan that you, whether by intention or mistake, you place him in the sort of conditions where he is going to confess or say confesses only if you've actually done it wrong, but states that he did something, even if he didn't do it, you're going to lock on that easy answer. You're going to lock in on that no matter, and then the blinders are really up. And when you're in a small town, when you're in a small space, and also you're not thinking deeply because you just want it to be solved. You want it to be over. You've got a lot of other cases you're working on. Again, look, I move out of the paradigm of the 30,000 foot level like we are, the backseat, you know, the Monday morning quarterbacks. I'm looking at, you know, what I was like as an investigator. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to move on to the next case. I'm trying to resolve this case, and I'm trying to bring some peace and justice to the family. Oh my God, I got a confession. Good, let's double down on this. Let's get this thing moved out of the way so I can move on to this. Because I got a chief breathing down my neck. I got all these other people breathing down my neck. I got problems that I got going on at home, and I just got to move forward on this case. So that's kind of the reality of what I think happens on these things. So it's easier to, every time someone doubles down on you, if you have some credibility because you have good relationships with the people around you, your prosecutors, your law enforcement partners and all that, and you say, but we have a confession, it's easier for them to say, well, he's a good guy. He hasn't been wrong before. He says he's got a confession. Let's all double down on that. Yeah. And so we wind up in the mess we're in.
Despite there being previous confessions. That's the part that gets me, is that with people who are much more likely to be a suspect in that case. Obviously.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, John. And that's why I really, really think there's linkages of relationships that we're not privy to, that we're just not seeing. Because when it doesn't make sense, it means we don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And even though we went through the trial process, even though, you know, we're pretty privy to everything the jury saw, we're not seeing everything because if it still doesn't make sense, we don't see everything. It's not making sense like we're looking for a motive. I just want to see the connections between either, you know, the law enforcement and Alan and ignoring all these other people or something. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, and as a collective in Delphi, they made that impossible. They were not going to let that into court. They weren't going to let any explanations into court of like why we came to this conclusion. And they certainly weren't going to let in anything that would contradict it, which was far more of that than there was actual evidence that pointed towards Richard Allen. This has got to be a difficult thing, you know, going back and trying to relitigate this and trying to get an appellate court to say, right, this should be seen again. Because even when it does, if it does, and I think the odds are pretty likely here that this is going to see a retrial, it has very strong odds that it's going to be put right back in the same place where it was. It could be Gull again. It could be really 2.0. An appellate court, the best they can do is say, okay, you're going to retry this, but you have to let these other elements in. Mm-hmm. And that's a strong suggestion. But as we've learned in other cases, and I talked with an attorney earlier today, Eric Faddis. I said, how much of it is that like mandated? How much of that is like it has to be done? You have no choice but to let this in. And how much of it is just like a really strong suggestion? And at the end of the day, the judge can still say, nah. Apparently, there's a good chance of nah if it gets thrown back down. Now, there could be consequences for the judge, but quite often there are not. So rolling the dice, if you really don't want this to go further, it still could not go further, even with an appellate court involved. And that just, I think, leads to the crux of all this is if you have one huge, if you have a town, if you have a multiple agencies in one town that all want to go one direction, no matter what, it doesn't matter what is best for reality, what is best for finding justice, we're all going to keep going down this road. You can throw out the safeguards. You can go to those other places that provide accountability. But if it ultimately goes back to the same place that's corrupt, you still don't get any real answers.
That's why no system is still perfect.
Yeah.
And, you know, we try to create a self-correcting system, as you and I were talking about beforehand. The book Nexus covers is that the only systems that are truly evolving are the ones that are self-correcting, mm-hmm. where they realize their mistakes, they challenge their assumptions, and they are able to adapt and move forward on them. And this might be one of those things. The only other thing that popped in my mind on this one is the only other data point that stands out as a reason possibly on this one is longevity, because you mentioned small town, and it is a small town from what I understand. You know, is longevity of people living there. From what I understand, Alan, he lived there for a while, but not his entire life. Him and his family had moved there. And so the other people that had been confessing, you know, we don't know relationships, longstanding relationships of that community. These might be generational families in that community. And I've seen this in other cases. And we saw this with the Alec Murdaugh case. You know, we have generational control. We have generational wealth. We have generational fear and impact of these families. Could that have played in it too? It's possible, which also could impact the appellate process as well. I just really, really hope at the end of the day, a jury gets to hear everything everyone knows and let them make the choice. You know, it just doesn't feel complete right now because it just doesn't, they just didn't hear everything. And misdeeds and all, you know, they should make, you know, a determination on whether it makes sense of him or someone else and come to a conclusion.
What a novel concept. Present evidence to a jury and let them decide.
Yeah, that's the way it's supposed to work, isn't it?
Seemed to elude the folks in Delphi on this one.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're in the thick of a true crime saga, every detail sinking in, and then, wham, a commercial about something you couldn't care less about. It's like being served a microwaved dinner at a five-star restaurant. But it doesn't have to be this way. Go for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today, Premium Plus, you get uninterrupted, ad-free episodes, extended interviews that dig even deeper into the muck, and early access so you can brag to your friends. It's like ordering the secret menu at a crime buffet. So, search for True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and savor every twisted detail without interruption.